Hello, everybody. Welcome to this afternoon's edition of the Daily Friend Rap Show. My name is Makoni Maja. I'm joined by one of the finest gentlemen from the Institute of Race Relations, Terence Corrigan. And we are going to take you through some of the most interesting stories for today. Let's start with the first one, which is from Business Day. And it's titled Top Investor Warns of Capital Flights as Contract Killings Grip South Africa. So these are basically reactions from 91, asset management company CEO, Mr. Hendrik du Toit, who is reacting to a recent one of these murders of financial accountability professionals. Mr. Boa van Niekerk, who was an insolvency lawyer, was recently assassinated, I believe it was Friday, in his office in Johannesburg after working on a contentious business rescue company. Mr. du Toit presides over about 3.3 trillion rands in assets, according to this article. And the article also recalls that, you know, Boa van Niekerk joins a list of other business rescue experts who have been murdered, including the double murders of father and son, Klutz and Murray, who 2 years ago were also involved in a hit that saw to their unfortunate death. He had this to say, that's the CEO of 91, Mr. du Toit had this to say, and I quote, "Our law enforcement agencies are in a woeful state, but to date, our judicial system has held firm. But how much longer can it withstand the combination of lawlessness and the lack of urgency from the government to reform our law enforcement agencies?" And he said, "We cannot and should not remain silent on this crisis. Neither should our leaders be indecisive on the course of action. We need to stop this rot." So apparently Mr. van Niekerk was winding down this company named NTC Global Trade Fund, which was suspected to be involved in Ponzi scheme activities. Although the sole director of this company, one Mr. Edwin Letoba, has come out and denied this. The article alleges that he had been quite difficult in relinquishing power of his company so that these business rescue practitioners can exercise management and control over the firm. And subsequent to the murder of Mr. van Niekerk, his co-business rescue practitioner, Mr. Kurt Robert Knoop, quit as the one of the NTC rescue practitioners, citing the death threats that him and Mr. van Niekerk had received, allegedly related to their work with this company. So Terence, it is true. It looks like the Ngabi industry is on the rise. And when we factor in risks of doing business in South Africa, we always look at, you know, logistical and structural constraints, be they Eskom or Transnet, or even policy ones like, you know, BEE and employment equity. But it seems that these murders and of practitioners, whistleblowers, are quickly coming on the scene as real threats to doing business in South Africa, including things like mafias, right? Corruption mafias, water mafias, construction mafias. What is your reaction to Mr. du Toit's comments?
Yeah, just first of all, a comment about Boa van Niekerk. The idea that you could literally walk into his boardroom and shoot him, that takes a particular type of brazenness. We've been facing a serious crime problem for years and years. You can actually look at the look at the rising numbers. I mean, this is a phenomenon that predates 94, sort of started to really tick up in the 1970s. South Africa is a violent society, and that holds implications for business. Now, there's a great deal of anecdotal evidence that a lot of foreigners avoid South Africa because of that. I know of one company that was looking at a deal with a correspondent firm in the United States, and all set to go, but due diligence, the American businessman had to come and see the plant in South Africa. His wife happened to just Google, you know, this small town, And first thing that jumped up were roadblocks, burning tires, and she just said there's no way that she's going to allow her husband to go. Deal falls through, lots and lots of American dollars lost, market opportunities. I've been told, actually, I was told by the same businessman that for a kind of medium-sized firm, they spend easily 1.5 million rand every year on security costs. He says every rand they're not able to spend on, chasing those business opportunities in America, or for that matter, employing people from the depressed area of the country where they're located. There is something that is particularly sinister about the sort of assassination business. This is where countries like Colombia ended up, where you can't touch the criminals because the whole system is contaminated, and those who are meant to protect you are either in their pockets or they're in a threat themselves. The illustrative cases in South America, and I think also in Italy, where drug cartels or mafia syndicates have been taken on, and you end up with a judge, because often in those legal systems it's the judge who does the investigation, literally having to be guarded by your sort of special forces 24 hours a day and probably for the rest of his life. There's a lot of people who just won't, who are just not going to go there, and I can't fault the liquidator. He says this is just not worth it. You'll go abroad, or you'll stick to doing contentious personal estates where the worst you're going to get is shouted at by the by the jilted ex-wife because everything was left to the mistress. But this is like long-term unraveling of our institutions. When you deny them the capacity or the imperative of acting with the professionalism that they need to, what else do you expect?
Sure. I, as you describe, these images of judges being surrounded by, security forces to protect them. I'm reminded of these reports emerging about the Madlanga Commission into the investigation of capture of police, as alleged by Lieutenant General Ndlandla Mkhwanazi, that even the witnesses who will be testifying at the commission are also being provided with various security. Some identities will be concealed entirely because their lives too are at risk. It's such a risky business being in those professions in South Africa, these financial, ethical, accountability professions, or even being a whistleblower. It's a deadly, deadly affair
Well,
operating.
remember Babita Deokaran. I mean, that's the iconic case that she tried raised the threat to her life. And I imagine that there are many people within the security services who will look at the risk reward ratio and say, well, either they can chase the bad guys down, probably end in a hail of bullets, and probably your wife and kids too, or maybe you can just take the million rand in cash in a brown paper bag and just quietly drop this, and maybe you can rationalize it to yourself, well, there'll never be a conviction anyway. I think it's very, very, very scary that people are now talking about the courts as being dragged into this. They've generally been, with some weaknesses here and there, generally been, performed fairly well. If we get to a situation where no one trusts the courts, I think it's a complete turkey shoot.
So true. I think so many of us are waiting with bated breath, to see whether there's any evidence to support those allegations that the rot goes all the way up into the judiciary. Would be quite devastating. But let's move on to our second story. This one is about a court case that's been years in the making, almost a decade. It's going to be 9 years next year when it finally holds in court. This is about Busisiwe Mkhwebane, who News24 says 5 years later, Mkhwebane to finally stand trial for perjury. So I've had to go look into the story because I wasn't familiar, but you are, Terrence. But let me set the scene for our listeners. The year is 1992, and There is a privately owned bank operating at the time, named Bancorp. Bancorp received a bailout from the South African Reserve Bank, but it's later acquired by Absa. 25 years after 1992, when Bancorp received this bailout, in 2017, the public protector at the time, Busisiwe Mkhwebane, finds that the bailout was, and I quote, an illegal gift by the South African Reserve Bank, and she makes a few recommendations, including that Absa, which acquired Bancorp, should pay back the money totaling 1.1 billion rand. And she also makes a direct call to Parliament to amend the South African Constitution, what it says about the South African Reserve Bank's mandate. She is alleged to have misrepresented her meetings with various people from Absa, including who she spoke to and the contents of these discussions. And a criminal case was opened against her for these allegations. I think the 2 months after the report was released, the Gauteng High Court set aside her directive to Parliament to change the Reserve Bank, saying that it violated the separation of powers. And then some 6 months after that, in February 2018, there was another set-aside order to all the remedial actions, including that Absa should pay back the money, the 1.1 billion rand. And coupled with that, there was a cost order, personal cost order made against her, and she's been unsuccessful in overturning that at the Crown Court. Sure. A mouthful, Terence.
Yeah.
How do
Right.
you?
Okay. I think one has to understand a little political detail of this. This is kind of this became a kind of exhibit for the white monopoly capital narrative. The reason the story had persisted, I mean, who remembers what the Reserve Bank was doing in 1992? Who knows what the Reserve Bank is doing now? But it the narrative was that it was the Afrikaner governor of the Reserve Bank, then Dr. Chris Stolz, who approved this bailout to an Afrikaans-owned firm, and that shows how the phrase "bikies for booties," jackets for your brothers. And Musin Kubani was sort of a, if I can put it, a creature of the Zuma project. She did not exactly cover herself with glory during her tenure. But this is the kind of thing that I think really appealed to the whole to the whole Zuma narrative. The Bancorp case, I think, has been discussed and analyzed to death, and although it was controversial, as these things always are, I don't think anyone has ever really identified a fatal legal problem. What struck me, though, was that was just the overreach in her judgment that we go from saying that the bailout is illegal to saying, well, we've got to change the constitution. It's not for a public for a public servant to make that sort of judgment. That is the purview of politicians to decide whether or not this sort of change is necessary. Her remit was very limited. She made a bad judgment, and she exceeded her authority. And now, 5 years later, finally, she's having to appear and dance before the piper. I do think, though, getting this connects with the previous story, in that 5 years is a long time. We saw much the same thing with Ms. Mayeni around SAA. The constant shuffling and ducking and diving and pleading of poverty. And it's not unusual for people to be facing very, very serious allegations and to just sort of spend the last couple of years of their lives living on the taxpayer's dime under suspension, and then quietly dying before before they for their answer. been allegations that this has happened, for instance, in the Babita Deokaran case. Tragic, very, very, tragic, and I suppose one can say better safe than never, but I really do wish that the machinery of justice would move more expeditiously.
I think with Mukwabane, things particularly take a wild turn because she then gets sworn in as a member of parliament, right?
Yeah.
This is the quality and the depth of our MPs, but also people who now sit on our opposition benches. And as a member of parliament herself, I wonder what she would say reflecting on the directives that she once gave to MPs to amend the constitution. It's wild.
The state of our parliamentary representatives leaves something to be desired and has for a long time. Let me say this: it's been a lot of complaining, and this is not a new thing. This goes back decades, about parliamentarians acting as effective voting fodder for party bosses. Now that's also sparked a lot of the discussion about reforming the electoral system, but I don't think it's going to be decisive for various reasons. But I certainly have spoken to people who complain about guys showing up, having not read any of their documents, not being not really not understanding the issues, let alone going and doing extra reading and trying to understand, what does this number mean in context. So I imagine a lot of things sort of get flushed by because we just don't understand, or you're not sufficiently interested to inform yourself. But then there's also something deeply concerning about, for instance, having someone on the Judicial Services Commission who himself a debarred judge. There's just something that screams conflict of interest. And but I am going to say South Africa's voters need to think very, very carefully about this, because these ethical lapses are not a new thing. I'm old enough to remember things like the Travelgate scandal. Now, funnily enough, speaking to an opposition MP, what was happening was MPs mostly from the ANC. This was 2007, if memory serves. We're going to a travel agent, cashing in their parliamentary travel vouchers, and then basically ripping off parliament. So you get some cash, and the agency gets some cash. One of the opposition MPs said that the tragedy here was that this was an opportunity actually to introduce some sort of reform. So many of these people do not come from very sort of sophisticated backgrounds. Maybe they never operated a bank account before. And he says in many ways, and like I say, I emphasize, it was an opposition guy speaking. He says in many ways they were victimized just as much as the public purse was. But the matter was reduced to a few verbal reprimands in Parliament. There was a list that apparently came to nearly 200 names or thereabouts, including a number of cabinet ministers. And it just kind of like faded into the background. We never got to see who was involved. No one was really made an example of, because I imagine there were people who were tricked, and I imagine there were some people who took advantage. But yes, if you're not willing to willing to put a sting into some of this, well, you're going to get exactly the same result again and again and again.
Indeed, a debarred judge and public protector who are now sworn members of parliament and are
And
expected to exercise oversight.
don't believe in the Constitution that they supposedly,
Uphold, indeed, indeed. They write themselves, Terence.
It's a dark joke, I must say.
Last story for today is one from Parliament, actually. We're back in Parliament here with News 24 describing Ms. Kusela Diko, Chairperson of Parliament's Committee on Communications and Digital Technologies, describing SABC as a recipe for disaster, SABC model, rather, operating model. as she warns that the state-owned entity may not survive past December. I think she's working about the model where SABC is coupled with Sentech, that it's quite fragile at present. She has warned that it may cease op the SABC may cease operations if its funding model are not finalized by year end. And she is saying this amidst Communications Minister Solly Malatsi telling the committee that his department would appoint a service provider to help create a new model for the state broadcaster following his controversial decision to withdraw the SABC bill last year. Speaking at a briefing on Monday, Kusela said that this was a recipe for disaster, the withdrawal of the bill, and nothing that will quickly come to support the SABC's operations for the remainder of the year. And I quote her as she says, "I'm worried when he, Malatsi, says it should be done in 3 months. When we spoke to Sentech, Sentech is a state-owned, another state-owned company that provides digital infrastructure and delivers signal distribution for the public and commercial community radio and TV stations." So she says when they spoke to Sentech and the SABC, they indicated that they could not continue with their operations in the current state beyond December of this year. She continues, "Sentech has warned that they would cut off the signal distribution because they could not carry the SABC anymore. This is because the SABC has struggled to fund its 2.3 billion rand public service mandate amid what News 24 describes as a decreasing advertising rate and TV license evasion rate of 85%, as well as insufficient budget allocations. The SABC had allegedly told Parliament previously that its unfunded mandate costs would be more than 7 billion rand over the medium term. Terence, is this the death of cable network as we know it? Has the internet, the rise of the internet, slit the television skirt?
There are a number of things going on here, and what and once again, my lamentably advanced age gives me a certain perspective on this. I'm old enough to remember when you used to get these guys in grey overcoats who would come knocking on your door with a clipboard to check your license. It was literally a card you had to show them, and it was taken quite seriously, but. In the old dispensation, the SABC was conceptualized as a state broadcast. In other words, it served the government. And there was a lot of interference. And when the transition happened, the idea was we're going to get a public broadcaster that would serve the people of the country and would be sort of independent from political pressure. And it would represent a diversity of views. That I don't think was ever something that the ANC took seriously. In fact, they went to try and capture it even before the 94 election was held. Subsequent to 1994, the editorial line was, more or less pro ANC, sometimes quite slavishly so. And you had instances where programs were being pulled because, the incumbent president or cabinet minister was upset about it. You had people being blacklisted from appearing because they were critical of government policy. All of this is not controversial. I think, and what happened over that was that they alienated a large part of the middle class support or middle class viewership. And let me not put too fine a point in it. White opposition voting people, just so, why should you pay for something that is intrinsically kind of hostile to my political choices? You had options like Mnet if you want for the entertainment, and increasingly also for the sport, which was a big thing. And the sort of quality of programming decline. I remember they. Issy Dingo, for instance, was a big thing, and they kept a lot of artists employed, but increasingly, they weren't paying for the their bills, And then came the internet. You know, all of a sudden you could stream and you could like watch things on YouTube. You know, on YouTube, all of your B movie needs are well catered for. Believe me, I've watched enough schlocky stuff from the 1980s. It's just a different way of being entertained. The licensing thing has become a joke. Advertisers don't see the audiences there. You know, rather put something on Facebook or, you know, on YouTube. I'm being told constantly I need Tai Chi. I might check that out. Apparently, in 3 days, you know, you'll see more energy. It's a different world. It's rather like what happened to the post office. And I actually like the post office. You know, I grew up where you used to actually write letters. But it didn't adapt. I don't think the minister has been particularly helpful. I do get a sense of you know, a bit of a lackadaisical approach to it. But so in a sense, you know, everybody has something correct to contribute here. The model is not viable. But I'm not sure whether you can actually retain the service as it exists. And that is not something to celebrate, because there are, you know, rural corners of the country where, you know, vernacular radio in particular is important. Although there again, you are finding podcasters who are speaking in Setswana and whatever, and there's a lot of this community radio that's springing up. So yeah, increasingly we just don't have this. There just isn't that sort of role anymore. Certainly not in an open society. You know, North Korea, you take what you can get and you say thank you for it. In South Africa, you walk away, and given the state of lawlessness in this country, you dare the government to come and collect your TV license. My sense is that there will still be an SABC beyond beyond December, but it's not a viable proposition as it stands, and I think the time for a discussion of that is long overdue. Whether part of it is maybe sold off or some sort of equity partner is brought in, but not as it is.
Yeah, I must agree. I think poor management also reminds me of the state capture era. There was sufficient hollowing out of the SABC then as well. So I think that probably just accelerated its decline. And I agree. I don't think the internet helped. In fact, it made things worse. As telling you that when you get on the HOW train and you look around, people are on their phones watching Netflix, people are streaming podcasts through their headsets. You know, you're not lugging around the SABC on your phone so you can catch up on an episode. And even then, people watch, like, illegally watch SABC stuff on YouTube that some people steal and then upload onto YouTube. Convenient. I think that's what we're chasing now, the age of the internet.
Well, look, you know, I can just scroll this back, which some of our more senior viewers, people like me, might remember. You know, you would sort of come home from school, and you know, the sort of broadcasts, I'm talking from mid-80s, would kind of start around 4 o'clock. And then there was one menu of things to watch, and the whole family used to watch them as usually like some sort of sitcom and the news show, which of course, you know, varied in accuracy and quality and whatever. But yeah, you know, with all those caveats. And then there was some sort of drama or crime show for about an hour between 7 and 8, and then we have the news again, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Saturday night they'd usually have a 1 hour drama, and then the Saturday night movie. Those are sort of institutions that was the way that you sort of imbibed your viewing experience. Then Mnet came along, and you know, you had some sort of choice, but you still had to choose, you know, do you watch this at this time? It's a completely different world. You know, you can sit and binge yourself on Karate Kid on Netflix, you know, literally for 3 or 4 days at a time without showering or anything, which some people sadly do. But as I say, things have moved on. people who tune into the Daily Friend show don't need, midweek, like, as we had in the mid-80s, and it was SABC 3, if I'm not mistaken, SABC 1. Like, I can't remember, it was a long time ago. But that you see where I'm going. I think I do think that there is a role for public information dissemination, but it has to be highly credible, high quality, and it has, people need to choose that as an option over some, over the commercial or the sort of internet generated stuff, and until you can make that offering, it's just not something that's going to that's going to pull in the eyeballs. And whether the
Yeah.
advertiser.
I would also think someone like Malatsi is the man for the job, but you're right about his approach so far. It's been rather, it's not taking it as seriously as at least Ms. Diko seems to be raising it to be a concern. Perhaps she's alarmist, I don't know. But December is right around the corner, so let's see how this funding model with Zentech carrying the SABC holds over. Any final comments?
Well, I did see in that article there was a picture of Malatsi and Diko hugging each other, which I thought was quite sweet. Like, we have so much polarization. I think it's good that people from different sides of the aisle can give each other a hug.
Yeah, it was very endearing, I agree.
So yeah, that I mean that's nice. It does remind us that whatever our differences, we should be opponents, not enemies.
Thank you.
And we need to take our problem seriously.
There we go. There you have it. Thank you, Terence.
Welcome,
That
Makoto.
is it from us. We will be back here tomorrow with another episode of the Daily Friend Rapture. Although Nicholas will be back at the helm, I'm sure you're happy to hear that. Thanks for having us, and that is a wrap.
The Daily Friend Show and the Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.